I think we've got a problem. We need to fix it. Everybody agrees we need to fix it, and we're going to work on that.
Senator McConnell, you have a problem.
Good luck on that, Senator McConnell. Yeah, you got a problem, all right.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Wonder who caused that problem.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Must be the Democrats.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ and in Cottage Grove on Queso. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, New Orleans, WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle, Washington's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth, 5 days a week. You can run, but you can't hide from the Bradcast as much as I might like to each and every day these days. But yeah. Actually, not today, Desi Doyen.
Okay.
Coming up, we've got a huge loss and a huge personal humiliation to go with it from the judge in this case. This judge, a Republican, George W. Bush appointed judge, by the way. Above and beyond the legal loss itself, there's this personal humiliation, which is really quite fun, for the nation's top, if quickly fading, GOP voter fraud fraudster, Kris Kobach, the Kansas Republican Secretary of State, and national embarrassment, as if we don't have enough of those these days, who is now running, by the way, to become governor of the great state of Kansas this year. We'll be joined shortly by one of the ACLU attorneys who fought and on Monday won the long and embarrassing case against Kobach's proof of citizenship requirement for voter registration in Kansas, which served only to keep tens of thousands of perfectly legal Kansas voters from being able to vote at all. As designed, and as if that's not enough, the ACLU has today filed yet another lawsuit against Kris Kobach after winning that one over his cross-check scheme to supposedly stop voters from registering to vote in two separate states. The ACLU's Sophia Lakin will join us momentarily to discuss all of that and more. So there's that.
Yes.
And if that's not enough to cheer you up today, Desi Doyen will be here with one of her always cheerful Green News reports.
Well, we try. We try to make them cheerful, even when they're not necessarily.
Yeah, and today's isn't very cheerful.
Well.
In any event, let's see here. Senate Republicans, according to the New York Times, just before air today, vowed to pass a bill ending child separations at the border, as Donald Trump continued to defend his administration's zero tolerance policy. Well, I will believe that when I see it. As the Times notes, GOP lawmakers are increasingly desperate at this point to fix the problem that Trump himself created on his own. No, it's not the Democrats' fault, as he continues to falsely argue today. So the Republicans want to fix this problem very, very quickly. But I would suggest it will not be easy for them. Trump is digging in his heels. According to the paper, Republican senators moved on Tuesday to defuse a political crisis of their own making and of Donald Trump's own making, I should add, by seeking passage of legislation that would swiftly bring an end to Trump's practice of separating children from their parents when families cross into the U.S. illegally. Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the majority leader, said that, quote, all of the members of the Republican Congress support a plan that keeps families together, endorsing an approach that would provide legal authority to detain parents and children together while their legal status in the country is assessed by the courts. So they're essentially pretending that they have to pass a law in order to make it such that parents who are detained don't have to be separated from their children. But the only reason they have to be separated is because Donald Trump decided to start charging them with felonies instead of the misdemeanor charge that it is and that it has been for years. Under several of the schemes Republicans are now trying to pull together, asylum claims would be expedited by adding more immigration judges or allowing families to be processed before others are processed, according to Republican senators. McConnell said he plans to reach out to Democrats to support the effort, hoping to stop the political damage from an administration policy that led to heartbreaking stories of children separated from their mothers, brutal images of children in makeshift detention camps. But Republicans, it seems, may not like, Democrats may not like helping the GOP out of this mess that they created and that the president created. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the Democratic minority leader, immediately shot down the Republican approach, saying that Trump could and should use his executive authority, not legislation, to quickly end the family separations. Schumer said there are so many obstacles to legislation, and when the president can do it with his own pen, it makes no sense.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be really getting across a lot of the media, the corporate media that's reporting on this. They do seem to be saying, well, you know, Trump changed the policy. But they, by covering the Republicans' desire to pass a law, they reinforce this false concept that it needs a law. It doesn't need a law. He can pick up the phone. Trump can pick up the phone and fix this problem and end it right now.
Well, yes, but of course they have to cover the fact that Republicans are scrambling now to try to pass legislation.
That is unnecessary, but yes.
Unnecessary?
Yeah.
Oh, to pass a legislation,
exactly.
Not to cover it. Yeah. In this case, any legislation, this is the problem. This is, I think, what Schumer is talking about. Anything they try to pass is going to be larded up with all kinds of poison pill provisions. Because Republicans have proven they are either unable or too cowardly to stand up to this president and pass, you know, a simple bill that would do one thing, like end his family separation policy, or one thing, restore the DACA program that all the Republicans claim to support, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that Obama put in place. They all claim to support that. And they could pass a bill that restores the protection to immigrant children who came here years ago with their parents, kids who are in the DACA program, but that Trump stopped protection for with the stroke of his pen last year. If they're really bothered by it, they can pass a single bill that has that doesn't have billions of dollars for the wall and end family reunification and the visa lottery program. They can do that. They don't want to do that. We'll see if maybe they do now, though. The Republican scramble, the Times reports, emerged even as Trump remained defiant in the face of calls to abandon his zero-tolerance policy of prosecuting everyone who crosses the border. That forced officials to take more than 2,300 children away from their parents in just the past 2 months, since mid-April. 2,300 children. Nonetheless, in an afternoon speech, Trump continued to falsely blame Democrats for causing this problem and dismissed as, quote, crazy, several of the Republican proposals to address the issue. Throughout the day, Trump gave no sign of relenting on his zero tolerance policy, even as outrage about it has intensified. The president once blamed Democrats for supporting, quote, crippling loopholes that cause family separation. This was a series of tweets along with this speech that Trump gave this afternoon, and he claimed without evidence that the Democratic politicians are eager to let members of MS-13 and other violent gangs into the United States.
Oh, God.
So they can eventually vote for Democrats. And you'll notice now that the trick they're trying to do, that Kirsten Nielsen, Nielsen,
Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security,
there are only two options here. Do what the administration is doing now or have a completely open borders policy.
Only two options.
That's it.
That's all there
is. Can't think
There's
of anything
nothing
else.
Nothing in the middle. No other administration has ever done anything else other than those
That's
two
it.
Only options.
Yeah. And oddly enough, the Trump administration seems to have found some other option prior to, what was it, April 16, when they put in this this new policy? So somewhere there must be some other solution. But no, those are the only two. That's what Kirsten Nielsen said yesterday.
Secretary Nielsen.
It confuses me because she has a J in the middle of the name, totally inappropriately. Kirstjen. She called for that on Monday. Donald Trump repeated that again today in his speech to this business group. To other business groups, however, are the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the biggest supporter of Republicans in the nation when it comes to elections. They put more money into elections than anyone else. So the U.S. Chamber and the Business Roundtable both condemned the practice of separating children from their parents. The roundtable called it, quote, cruel and contrary to American values. The chamber's top official said, quote, this is not who we are and it must end now. Well, this is who we are now, Chamber of Commerce. These are the folks that you have been supporting and spending hundreds of millions of dollars to get elected now for years, year after year after year. We wouldn't even be in this shape, most likely, had Republicans that you supported, Chamber of Commerce, if they had had the courage to deal with all sorts of immigration problems that we've had going back for years now. But they would not even allow a vote on immigration, on any aspect of immigration, to come up for a vote in the U.S. Senate, any sort of plan in the U.S. Senate or the U.S. House, any plan that actually could have passed. Nonetheless, on Capitol Hill, the Republican backlash against the policy grew louder and louder today. Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, is asking his Senate colleagues to sign a letter to the Justice Department requesting a, quote, pause on family separations. Oh, pretty please. At least until Congress can pass legislation. Hatch told reporters on Monday that the separation policy was not American, except it is, apparently. Senator Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, said in a statement, quote, I oppose the Trump administration's policy of separating children from their parents. This is counter to our values. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin and chair of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, said he was working on legislation that would keep families together while increasing the number of federal immigration judges so court hearings could be faster, could be expedited. Ted Cruz of Texas is proposing something similar. Over in the House, Congressman Mark Meadows of North Carolina, he's the chair of the right-wing House Freedom Caucus, used to be the Tea Party Caucus. He also said that he was going to introduce a measure that would more easily allow family units to stay together as part of a legislative package. But therein lies the rub. If it's a package, it ain't going to pass because they're going to put all kinds of crap in there that Democrats can't possibly support. But members of the president's party themselves were expressing deep concern about the need to move quickly to end family separations, something that would be difficult to achieve as part of a debate over fixing the immigration system. So they know they have a problem. They know they're not going to be able to do this as part of a package. At least the leadership does. What the rank and file and what the U.S. House has to say, well, that remains to be seen. Of course, that's not the only havoc that Trump is now causing without apology, though it's finally, thankfully, getting some attention, the attention that it deserves from the corporate media. But at the same time, markets plummeted on Monday following Trump's vow to add $200 billion in tariffs. $200 billion in tariffs to his ongoing trade war with China after China responded to Trump's initial sanctions, or tariffs. They responded with promises for $50 billion of their own tariffs on American goods exported to China. More on that in our Green News report today, and likely on an upcoming show, because Trump's family separation policy is also causing problems with the rest of the world. Just before we go to air today, the U.S. announced Tuesday it was leaving the United Nations Human Rights Council. U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley called it, quote, an organization that is not worthy of its name. This, as AP notes, is the latest withdrawal by the Trump administration from an international institution as we retract from the rest of the world. Haley, who is Trump's envoy to the UN, said the U.S. had given the human rights body, quote, opportunity after opportunity to make changes. But she lambasted the council for, quote, its chronic bias against Israel, and lamented the fact that its membership includes human rights abusers such as China, Cuba, Venezuela, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Haley said, we take this step because our commitment does not allow us to remain a part of a hypocritical and self-serving organization that makes a mockery of human rights. I would add that actually they take this step because on Monday, the outgoing head of the Human Rights UN Human Rights Council blasted the U.S. and Donald Trump for the cruel family separations policy. I know it's just a coincidence that we pulled out of the Human Rights Council the very next day after the head of the Human Rights Council blasted the U.S. As we noted on yesterday's program, U.N. Human Rights Chief Zayed Raad al-Hussein denounced the Trump administration for separating migrant children from parents, calling the policy unconscionable and an abuse. In the U.S., he said, as he listed concerns he has with a number of countries in his last speech as head of that body, he said, I am deeply concerned by recently adopted policies which punish children for their parents' actions. The thought that any state would seek to deter parents by inflicting such abuse on children is unconscionable, he said. Al-Hussein also cited the American Association of Pediatrics in describing the U.S. policy as, quote, government-sanctioned child abuse, which may cause, quote, irreparable harm. Again, just a coincidence that he said that yesterday and the U.S. pulled out of the Human Rights Council entirely today. The U.S. current term on the council ends next year. It's not immediately clear if the U.S. would remain a non-voting observer on the council, but a full pullout by the U.S. leaves the council without one of its traditional defenders of human rights. The U.S. pullout was bound to have a ripple effect for at least two countries at the council, China and Israel. The U.S., as at other U.N. organizations, is Israel's biggest defender. And at the Human Rights Council, the U.S. has recently been the most unabashed critic of rights abuses in China. Barbara Lee, congresswoman from California, who serves as the Democratic U.S. congressional representative to the United Nations General Assembly, said this decision serves no purpose other than to weaken our leadership on the world stage and isolate us from our allies. She said, with sensitive negotiations underway with North Korea and ongoing human rights abuses happening around the world, our government should be upholding our commitments, not retreating from our role in protecting human rights. Relinquishing our seat at the table, she said, will not advance human rights. It won't empower the oppressed. It will only undermine America's credibility in the world. Not that we need much help with that. So with the U.S. now gone, they won't be there to either defend Israel or hold China accountable. Well thought through, guys. You know who else doesn't seem to think things through very well? That would be the outgoing Secretary of State of Kansas, Kris Kobach, whose absurd policy that prevented some voters from voting if they didn't turn over citizenship papers in Kansas That was struck down by a federal judge on Monday, along with an absolutely humiliating slapdown to Kobach himself. Really? We'll be joined by a member of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project legal team who was on the ground and in the courtroom for the remarkable trial in Kansas. She joins us next to explain the latest humiliation for Kris Kobach, the nation's top GOP voter fraud fraudster, as the existential fight to put at least some brakes on our continuing national emergency this November at the polling place continues. With a little bit of good news today for a change, I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast.
Carry on, my wayward son. There'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest. Don't you cry no more.
Yes, it's Kris Kobach's theme song. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. 8 years ago, back during his initial campaign to become Kansas Secretary of State in 2010, Republican Kris Kobach ran pretty much on one single issue. It was on all of his campaign materials and signs at the time. Inside a big red stop sign shape, it said, "Stop voter fraud." That was his issue, to stop all of those dastardly Democrats and non-citizens from casting unlawful ballots, ruining elections in Kansas, where Republicans have controlled the mechanisms of most state and local government, as well as U.S. House and Senate seat, for years. After becoming Secretary of State in 2010 on the premise of stopping voter fraud, there was a problem. Kris Kobach was unable to find almost any of it. Nonetheless, that didn't prevent him from instituting photo ID voting restrictions at the polling place, which GOP voter fraud fraudsters have long pretended was needed in order to stop fraud, when in reality, study after study has shown that it's meant to stop perfectly legal Democratic-leaning voters who are less likely to have the type of very specific government-issued photo IDs required for voting at the polling place under these Republican laws. Polling place fraud is, of course, very rare, at least the type that photo ID voting restrictions could even possibly prevent, but that has not prevented folks like Kobach from pretending otherwise in hopes of disenfranchising minorities, students, and other low-income voters who tend to lean Democratic. Sure, there might have been a lack of convictions for voter fraud in Kansas, but that was only because state and county prosecutors were refusing to bring cases against all of those voter fraud criminals in the state, Kobach argued. Those prosecutors must have been in on the scheme too, I guess. So Kobach was able to convince the state legislature to give him the power to prosecute fraud cases, making him the only Secretary of State in the nation to have such direct prosecutorial powers to bring cases of voter fraud himself. Out of millions of votes cast during his two terms so far as Secretary of State, he has, at last count, I believe, obtained 9 convictions, mostly of Republicans who voted in 2 different states, not knowing that they were not allowed to do so. But with those powers in hand, Kobach went further than any Republican voter fraud fraudster in the country. He convinced the legislature to pass a documentary proof of citizenship requirement for registering to vote at all in Kansas. If you couldn't present your papers, like a birth certificate, which many don't have, at least have on them when they register to vote, or even have at all, without paying money to obtain them, then you would not be allowed to vote in the state of Kansas under this law. Kobach even tried to force the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission, that's the federal agency that produces the National Voter Registration Form mandated by the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. He tried to convince the EAC to add a requirement to that form stating that voters specifically from Kansas would not be allowed to register with the national form unless they included their documentary proof of citizenship papers under this law. Despite a trip or two all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and back, Kobach was unable for years to get that provision added to the federal form. So Kobach just decided that he would create essentially two classes of voters in Kansas, those who would be allowed to vote in federal elections only in federal elections, if they had signed up on the national form but didn't include their proof of citizenship. And those Kansans who would vote in federal races as well as all state and local races if they did turn in their papers when registering to vote. None of this, of course, sat well with nonpartisan voting rights advocates across the country, including the ACLU and the League of Women Voters, who sued Kobach over that documentary papers please provision that he insisted was needed to prevent hordes of undocumented aliens from voting in Kansas elections. As the case moved through the court system, Donald Trump, a Kris Kobach fan because he saw him on Fox News all the time, somehow became president. And with the advice of Kobach, Trump declared that anywhere from 3 to 5 million voters must have voted illegally across the country in 2016, thus giving the popular vote to Hillary Clinton over Trump. So a presidential voter fraud commission needed to be formed, headed up by Kobach himself. After that commission, like the state of Kansas itself, failed to root out the fraud that Trump and Kobach had pretended existed, and after several very embarrassing lawsuits against the commission, which Kobach lost in virtually every way, the commission was disbanded. But the ACLU lawsuit against the proof of citizenship registration scheme back in Kansas continued in the federal court. In that suit, for some reason, Kris Kobach, who fancies himself a legal and constitutional scholar and expert, decided that he wanted to represent himself and the state of Kansas as its attorney. It did not go well. He lost motion after motion as the U.S. District Court Judge Julie Robinson, a Republican George W. Bush appointee, by the way, to the federal bench, after she was even forced to slap Kobach with sanctions for contempt, fining him $1,000 in the first instance and slapping him with a very humiliating sanction again on Monday of this week, as she released her final ruling in the case after a lengthy bench trial earlier this year in which Kobach and his team in the courtroom were reprimanded time and again for violating evidentiary and other standard courtroom procedures. As many had expected, Judge Robinson's verdict did not go well for Kobach, who is now, by the way, termed out as Secretary of State. So he's running for governor in Kansas this year. In any event, on Monday, as the Wichita Eagle reports, a federal judge struck down a Kansas voter citizenship law that Secretary of State Kris Kobach had personally defended, finding it in violation of the Constitution as well as the National Voter Registration Act. In a 118-page ruling on Monday, Robinson ordered a halt to the state's requirement that people provide proof of citizenship in order to register to vote. The decision holds the potential to make registration easier as the August primary and November general elections approach. That after tens of thousands of voter registrations had remained in various forms of limbo for years under this scheme. Robinson's ruling, the Eagle observes, amounted to a takedown of the law that Kobach had championed and lawmakers approved several years ago. She found that the scheme, quote, disproportionately impacts duly qualified registration applicants while only nominally preventing non-citizen voter registrations. She ordered Kobach not to enforce the proof of citizenship law and its accompanying regulations. This was a huge and hard-fought victory for voting rights advocates and for the ACLU, which led the legal battle for many years, and specifically a win for voters in Kansas. All of that was even before the new and humiliating sanctions that Robinson slapped Kobach with as part of her ruling on Monday. Joining us now to discuss that ruling, those new humiliating sanctions, and a new voting rights lawsuit against Kris Kobach on another matter just filed by the ACLU today is Sophia Lynn Lakin. She is a staff attorney with the ACLU's Voting Rights Project, one of the litigators in the Kansas courtroom as part of the ACLU's trial team on this case. She's actively litigating voting rights cases across the country and is involved in challenges to discriminatory voter ID and registration requirements, cutbacks to early voting and same-day registration, the dilution of minority votes in local elections, and other barriers to voting and discriminatory voting practices and procedures. I suspect she may be celebrating today, but it's going to be another busy year for Sophia. Sophia Lakin, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Congratulations on your big victory this week in Kansas. What was the essence of Judge Robinson's verdict here?
Well, I think you've recapped it pretty well, but at the end of the day, the judge pretty much agreed that Kris Kobach has been peddling pretty much a xenophobic lie that non-citizens are engaging in rampant election fraud, and this was his chance. This court battle that we just had was his chance to put on the record his evidence that this is what was happening. And the judge saw that evidence, and she agreed that there was very little evidence of non-citizen voting in Kansas, certainly not enough to justify the tens of thousands of individuals that have been disenfranchised by that requirement. And she struck it down under both federal law, the National Voter Registration Act, as well as under the U.S. Constitution. So now Kansas has pretty much the same registration requirements as nearly every other state in this country.
How many unlawful non-citizen registrations and actual votes was Kobach able to demonstrate during that trial that had occurred, I think, going back some 20 years during the trial?
Yeah, so over a course of about 15 years, from 1999 to 2013, Kobach was able to present just 39 confirmed non-citizens who were able to successfully get on the rolls. So that's 39 over a 15-year period. And of those 39 confirmed non-citizens who were able to get on the rolls, only 11 voted.
11 non-citizen voters in 20 years versus how many people was he talking about and were you guys fighting for to protect who were unable to vote in various ways due to this proof of citizenship requirement that he put in place?
Well, what we know is that the time that the law went into effect, that we were seeing about 35,000 eligible Kansans who were qualified, trying to register to vote, being blocked by the requirement. Now, because of the PI ruling that Judge Robinson had put into place about 2 years ago at this point, a lot of those individuals were able to get registered to vote. But we do know that we're talking about tens of thousands of individuals who were prevented from getting on the rolls and therefore prevented from voting.
Well, you know, election integrity, you got to stop those 11 non-citizens, even if it means 35,000 legitimate voters can't vote. And by the way, most of the, as I understand it, those 39 non-citizen registrations, most of whom did not vote, but they were found to be administrative errors. What type of administrative errors causes that?
Well, there are all different types, but one of the main ones, that because we were focused on individuals registering to vote at the DMV specifically, what we were seeing were situations where an individual who happened to be a non-citizen would go to try to get a driver's license, which they can do. Permanent residents obviously drive in the United States. They need driver's licenses to do so. Show up at the DMV, are asked to register to vote, even though the DMV official knows that this individual has just shown a document, a green card, most likely demonstrating that they're a non-citizen. They're therefore then asked, oh, by the way, do you want to register to vote? And this individual doesn't necessarily know whether or not they can register to vote. They're asked by a government official whether or not they want to. They think they should. They sign up and they get registered. There are also other types of mistakes that, for instance, someone could mark that somebody asked to be registered to vote when they didn't. Mm. There are all sorts of things that could happen along the way. But there are certainly bureaucratic mistakes that, that we've seen that were documented in emails between the Secretary of State's office and individuals there, and saying things like, we wish that DMV clerks wouldn't make these types of mistakes.
And the judge, I think, even pointed that out, that the remedy for these problems, if you consider 39 non-citizen registrations over 20 years to be a problem, that the remedy there is not to penalize legitimate voters, but to have better training for clerks at the DMV. Is that right?
That's certainly one place where they can do a much better job. The judge noted that, and we pointed to a number of different places where it was pretty obvious that, DMV workers weren't getting sufficient training on how to properly register individuals and not register inadvertently non-citizens.
Now, there were several different what they called suspension lists, I guess voters who registered but failed to include these proof of citizenship documents when they registered. One list, as I understand it, allowed those voters who use the federal form, that National Voter Registration Form, to vote only in federal elections, not in state elections. The other suspension list from Kobach barred these voters, if they signed up in state, barred them from voting in any election. Does Judge Robinson's verdict here restore all such registrations at this point, or just the ones who had used the federal form but then were prevented from voting and, well, who were only allowed to vote in federal elections until now?
So, just to clarify, there was a suspense list at one point in time that as you say, ensured that only individuals who registered with a DPOC could vote in all elections, and then a separate list for individuals who could only vote in federal elections. Now, those individuals, just so you know, it was not only that they could only vote in federal elections, they had to cast a provisional ballot in which somebody would then look at it and count only the federal elections and toss out all other ballots, votes that were cast on any other elections. Mm. Now, we actually went to court to sue Chris Kobach about this particular, this dual registration system, this sort of two-tiered system, and arguing that he was pretty much making up a system out of whole cloth. He didn't have any authority under any law in Kansas to do something like that. And we won. And that case is a separate case. And so individuals who registered to vote using the National Voter Registration Form as well as through the DMV were supposed to be allowed to vote in all elections and treated just like any other voter. Now, what the Judge Robinson's most recent ruling did was actually extend the abolition, essentially, of the documentary proof of citizenship requirement to all forms of registration. And the importance of that is that it extends the state form as well. So any way that you register to vote in Kansas now, you do not need to provide documentary proof of citizenship, not just if you use the federal form, not just if you register at DMV.
So that is indeed very good news for folks in Kansas. There's a similar law, Sophia Lakin, that the state of Arizona passed, where Kobach had helped advise them on that and on their so-called papers please law against those that law enforcement felt might be undocumented. That law was also struck down by the courts. But the proof of citizenship law, I believe, is for voter registration is still in place in Arizona, despite Monday's ruling in Kansas. Am I right about that?
So Arizona was one of the two states, or Kansas should no longer be enforcing, otherwise, you know, we will be in court again tomorrow. Arizona is one of the two states that have a documentary proof of citizenship requirement that they've been enforcing. There are two other states that also have them that have not been enforcing them, as far as we're aware. Arizona's is a little bit easier to satisfy, though, because you can use a driver's license number. And so that, at the very least, that provides some relief for individuals who don't have their documents, the underlying documents, like a birth certificate, passport, and naturalization documents, that our possession rates for those are so much lower. So there is a little bit of a difference there, but you're right, there is a requirement, a citizenship requirement there in Arizona as well.
And I hope that, I hope you guys are in court tomorrow on that one before we get to November when it comes to Arizona. I want to talk about these sanctions in one moment, but Kobach, of course, says he plans to appeal the court's ruling. In a statement, he noted that Judge Robinson is the first judge in the country to come to the extreme conclusion that requiring a voter to prove his citizenship is unconstitutional. Her conclusion is incorrect, and it is inconsistent with precedents of the U.S. Supreme Court. That was his statement there. Extreme, Sophia, your response to his statement here, and any guesses as to what might be the basis for an appeal in this case?
Well, I think it's kind of funny that
you sound like you were chuckling while I was reading that response.
Right, that she's the first judge to come to this conclusion. Well, I will say that Kobach is the first. This is the state. This is ground zero. This is where he is experimenting with Kansans' right to vote by imposing this show me your papers requirement in Kansas, and seeing how far that gets him. And so, of course, it's the first time that a court has struck this down, but I'm obviously not surprised by his statement. We're not surprised that he wants to appeal, and not surprised that he thinks that he has to at least say that he believes that he'll prevail. This has been the centerpiece of his voter suppression agenda, and his baby along the way. There's no doubt in my mind that he will continue to fight it. It's bound up with his entire agenda and life story. So that's not surprising at all. I think the Judge Robinson was extremely meticulous and careful, as you saw, 118 pages, where she's going through all the different things that were brought out in this very long trial. She, in fact, made us go to trial. We moved for summary judgment, tried to get a ruling on the papers in this case, and the judge very much wanted basically Kris Kobach to have his day in court to put his evidence of non-citizen voting to the test, to see what he was able to actually muster. We even reopened discovery for the very purposes of him doing that. And so, proof is in the pudding here. Yeah. He utterly failed to do anything there. And so, he can try to appeal this, but Judge Robinson really, really took the time to be careful and really document every single one of her findings.
And we should underscore that this judge was not one of these lefty, crazy liberals like Sophia Lakin of the ACLU. This was a George W. Bush appointed federal judge, George W. Bush. Sophia, we read report after report in the media during the trial of Kobach, sort of infuriating the judge throughout the trial, breaking rules and so forth. You were on the ground inside the courtroom. Was it as bad and embarrassing as the media reports seemed to suggest at the time?
I imagine it might have been worse. I think it was pretty shocking for everyone on the trial team, talking to people who were in the gallery, just members of the public, as well as, interested members of the media who said, now I know how to introduce evidence, because the judge had walked his trial team through that process so many times. It was pretty surprising, the lack of preparation, and lack of knowledge about sort of very basic evidentiary rules, as well as very basic trial procedure.
And any idea why he chose to represent himself? And he this was his choice. He could have hired someone to represent Kansas, but he chose to do it himself. Any idea why he chose to do that rather than hire a competent attorney, as far as you know?
Well, I believe that he thinks he is a competent attorney, and to the extent that he has argued before in appellate courts and other courts as well, I will say trial procedure is a different beast than all of that. Mm. I believe he thinks that he did a good job, potentially, for all I know. But, this is his baby. Like I said, it's a centerpiece of his voter suppression agenda, and I can't imagine that he'd feel comfortable leaving it to anybody else's hands and think that they would do the job and be sort of the zealous advocate for this and for, the cause of non-existent voter fraud. So that's that's my guess as to why. And, you know, I know he's made statements about this saving the state of Kansas money, but as you noted, that he's already been sanctioned once, $1,000 earlier in this case. A couple months ago, he was sanctioned again to pay our attorney's fees for another motion for contempt. And, you know, the petition that we filed was around $50,000. So I don't know how much money this ended up saving Kansas.
Well, when we heard about first that those initial sanctions for $1,000 and then to pay your attorney's fees, then the question was, what else was this going to cost the state of Kansas? How much more money to make up for his failure, I guess, as a litigator? But this time she added something else, and I think it's a rather unique and seems to me uniquely humiliating sanction against Kris Kobach in her ruling. Can you explain what Judge Robinson sanctioned him with? Embarrassing. Yeah.
So, yeah, Judge Robinson ordered ordered Kobach to go back to school. She ordered him to take an additional 6 hours of continuing legal education. Lawyers have to take continuing legal education to maintain their law licenses. So she said, on top of those requirements, you have to do another 6 hours, and they have to focus on civil procedure or evidence. And you have to come back to me and tell me and certify to this court that you've accomplished that and that you did that. Some of the tweets that I've seen out there is that Yale should get its money back.
Have you ever seen a judge impose something like that on an attorney? You need to go back to school for six more hours?
To be quite honest, I'm not sure I've seen so many sanctioned rulings against an attorney at all in a case.
Right.
But certainly this requirement to go back to school is unique in my mind. And I haven't seen something like that before. But
Is it also appealable, by the way?
I imagine he will appeal all of the sanctions rulings.
Wow.
Along with everything else.
So embarrassing for him. Actually, if for voters of Kansas, of any party, I mean, to just see your Secretary of State sort of be dragged through this sort of embarrassment of this and the Trump Election Integrity Commission, that debacle. I'm just kind of embarrassed for Kansas, and we'll see how they vote this year because Kobach's running for governor. But last question here, Sophia, just to maybe rub salt in the wound. I don't know. I guess the Kansas ACLU has filed yet another lawsuit now against Kobach today regarding his cross-check program, which purportedly shares the names of voters in some 26 states that are supposedly registered in both states. What does that lawsuit regard specifically? And gosh, I wonder if Kobach is going to decide to represent himself again.
Sure. So, you know, this lawsuit arose out of the inadvertent, or perhaps, I'm not sure it was inadvertent, it was a response to a public records request for various voter data from using cross-check information from the state of Florida, actually. And that through that records request, individuals' personal information was released to a member of the public and then the public at large. As a result, there's been more of a spotlight on exactly what is happening with this program, the Interstate Voter Registration Cross-Check System, which does, as you say, attempt to try to identify double voters or double registrants in the states that are members by comparing first name, last name, and date of birth across voter registration files in different states. And what states do is they upload their data into a FTP site, and then Kansas, through Kris Kobach's office, tries to match this information and then resends that information out into the world. But as you can imagine, there are so many problems with cross-check itself and being unreliable and so forth. There have been studies demonstrating that this type of methodology of comparing first name, last name, date of birth is 99% likely to result in a false positive and so forth. So terrible information. But this particular lawsuit is looking at how is that information, that personal information that you have, your social security number, your first name, last name, date of birth, all tied together in these voter registration files, and that information is being sent to and from different states. How is that information being protected and secured? Based on all this information that members of the public have been able to find based on information that the Secretary of State's office itself has said, that information is not secure. And so that's what this lawsuit is challenging, the fact that they are recklessly handling people's voter registration information, their personal and confidential information.
Not my Chris Kobach. Sophia Lakin, really appreciate you joining us here today. Congratulations again on this case. I suspect you'll be busy as he moves forward with his appeal, undoubtedly. Folks can find more information on the very important ACLU Voting Rights Project at ACLU.org. You can follow Sophia on the Twitters at SOPHLIN229, that's SOPHLIN, the number 229. And of course, you can follow ACLU on the Twitters at ACLU. And Sophia, I fear you're going to have a very busy year this year and probably for the next few. So thanks for taking time out to join us today and congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
You bet. All right, quick break, and we are back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. You know, maybe I was just too eager, too happy about Chris Kobach and Donald Trump's top vote suppressor. Spent too much time being happy about that.
Well, it was very satisfying.
So we are running late. Let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
So you get more rainfall, you get more wind damage, you also get greater storm surge.
Hurricanes are moving slower thanks to global warming. EPA's weakening of clean air rules could kill 80,000 Americans over the next decade. China's retaliatory tariffs hit U.S. energy companies and Alaska's seafood industry. Plus, climate change is already eroding home values across the country.
All of that good news and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
A perfect merger for the Trump age. Bayer has bought Monsanto. So it's one company, same great toxins.
Could things get any better? This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, speaking of things getting better, you've got nothing but good news for us today, don't you?
Well, that's one way of putting it. Yeah, it looks like President Trump's tit-for-tat trade war of tariffs is set to harm new corners of the U.S. economy. In response to Trump's approval of $50 billion in new tariffs on Chinese goods announced last week, China on Monday announced it would slap retaliatory trade tariffs on U.S. energy exports, including shipments of U.S. oil, coal, and petrochemicals. China is the third largest buyer of U.S. oil products. China will also hit Alaska's commercial fishing industry, slapping a 25% tariff on Alaskan seafood. Alaska's seafood exports to China were worth $750 million last year.
So Donald Trump is helping to put those coal miners back to work by making coal more expensive all over the world so that no one wants it?
That seems to be what he's aiming for.
The plan is sound.
Meanwhile, two Harvard scientists estimate that if the Trump Environmental Protection Agency succeeds in weakening clean air and clean water standards, some 80,000 more Americans could die every decade. In their controversial letter, it's not a study, but a letter, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, they say that their, quote, extremely conservative estimate is based on the EPA's own calculations of pollution's impact on public health. In a recent broadcast, environmental journalist David Roberts explained that Trump's rollback of pollution standards really amounts to a pollution tax on the American public.
Getting rid of these regulations is an upward income redistribution. inflation. You're taking money out of the pockets of ordinary people in the form of health costs mm-hmm. and missed work and all the rest of it, and you're putting it in the pockets of industrialists who are already wealthy.
Well, it's one thing to redistribute wealth when you're going from the rich to the poor. That's just outrageous. But taking money from the poor and giving it to the rich, that's just the American way.
And in this case, perhaps 80,000 more people will see early deaths.
Just the cost of doing business.
Meanwhile, hurricane systems are moving more slowly due to climate change, and that is bad news for everyone in their path. A new study from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration finds that because of warming at the poles, which is slowing down the jet stream that drives weather systems, hurricanes are moving about 10% slower than they used to. That's causing storms to stall and park in place, like Hurricane Harvey's record-breaking rain and flooding last year. That's according to lead author James Cawson here in an interview with NPR.
If the wind's blowing really hard and it blows a few more hours than it would have, the likelihood of knocking that structure down increase. So you get more rainfall, you get more wind damage, you also get greater storm surge. Slower storms will have a tendency to push a larger wall of water in front of them. So it's kind of a triple threat.
Well, yeah, we have seen this a lot in recent storms. I'm thinking going back to Superstorm Sandy, where these weather systems move in and they just kind of stay put and dump enormous amounts of rain in the bargain, in Sandy, in Harvey, and many other recent storms.
And it's already having an effect on home values. Last week, we reported on a study that found that South Florida home values are already changing in response to the risk of rising sea levels. Now, a new analysis by Bloomberg News released on Monday finds that climate concerns are also eroding home values elsewhere in the United States. Homes at high risk of floods dropped about 5% in price over the last decade, Bloomberg found, while homes with low flood risk jumped nearly 10% higher in value. Wildfire risk was also impacting home values. Again, homes with the lowest risk were valued much higher than homes that were at the highest risk of wildfires. They say that it's a sign that Americans may be starting to take climate change seriously, at least when it comes to buying a house. But finally, some good news. Thanks to the United Kingdom's planned ban of single-use plastic straws and similar items, fast food giant McDonald's has announced that it will switch to paper straws at all of its stores in the UK and Ireland starting in September of this year. But customers in the United States are going to have to wait a bit longer. McDonald's won't even begin testing plastic straw alternatives in its U.S. restaurants until later this year.
We have to test alternatives to plastic straws?
In some restaurants.
For much more on all of this madness, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
First straw so small it seemed impossible. The next straw vanished like shooting stars at bomb. The last straw, there's no reason for getting there at all.
No, there's not. Plastic straw fans will just have to suck it up.
Oh.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to my guest today, Sophia Lakin of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and I hope you'll find and follow me on the Twitters and the Facebooks at TheBradBlog. And my thanks to those of you who help keep us going by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. You are the only ones who do. bradblog.com/donate. Thank you. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.